Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Happy rainy Sunday to everybody out there. This is Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Our show today is being produced and engineered by Jack Inslee and sponsored by The Barter House. The Barter House is proud to support the Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. The Barter House works with family vineyards and small bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. Committed to sustainable agriculture and artisanal production, The Barter House offers outstanding wines at a wide range of price points to retailers, restaurateurs, and private collectors. To learn more about The Barter House, please visit them on the web at thebarterhouse.com or call them at 917-463-3076. And it is appropriate today that our show is being sponsored by a purveyor of alcoholic spirits because my guests today are experts in the realm of monastic cheese and monastic spirits. I am going to be talking with Diana Pettet and Kara Newman. Diana Pettet is a cheesemonger in New Jersey, and Kara Newman is the spirits reviewer for Wine Enthusiast Magazine and author of Spice and Ice, 60 Tongue-Tingling Cocktails. Thank you, ladies, for being on the show.
That was our pleasure.
So first of all, tell us about this program that you're doing, I believe, tomorrow night for the Culinary Historians.
Right. Both Kara and I are members of the Culinary Historians of New York, and they asked us to do a program on our favorite topic these days, monastic cheeses and liqueurs. And we'll be doing the program at the National Arts Club in Gramercy, and it starts at 7:30, the reception. And with there's going to be a lovely alchemist punch. Which punch is it?
It's going to be the alchemist punch made with Benedictine.
And there'll be some lovely monastic cheeses as well, and we'll talk about the history of both the liqueurs and the cheeses. And you can find out more about it at the Culinary Historians of New York's website, which is www.culinaryhistoriansny.org.
CulinaryHistoriansNY.org. Okay, and so that's tomorrow, Monday, December 13th at 7:30?
That's correct,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
7:30 is the reception, and 8 o'clock the program starts.
Sounds like a good way to spend a Monday night.
It is, and the National Arts Club is wonderfully decorated for the holidays. It's a truly spectacular spot.
I have never been in, actually, and it's one of those places where whenever I walk by, ride my bike by, I'm like, God, I got to find an excuse. So that's
here's your excuse.
Hey, there we go. So I know you two have done programs like this before, and I just think it's so fascinating because I feel like it's a subject that people don't really know too much about. When you say monastic cheeses, it doesn't sound totally sexy, to be honest, or totally tasty for that matter. You know, it sounds kind of dry, kind of churchy, you know. So what's the deal? How did you guys start this this line of education?
Well, I think it started for us earlier this year. Benedictine has their 500th anniversary this year, and it coincided with the first ever Manhattan Cocktail Classic. And Diana has long been an interest in all kinds of cheeses, and I just had an interest in the history of cheese, and I've long had an interest in cocktails and spirits, and especially the history of cocktails and spirits. And we just found this to be a great way to bring two things we really were interested in together.
Absolutely. And so for all of our listeners out there, can you describe a little bit the tradition of making cheese and spirits in monasteries?
Sure. I think it's great that you pointed out that monastic cheeses doesn't sound very sexy. And it's true that when we picture the monastic life, it sounds like one of deprivation and one that we wouldn't really want to partake in particularly. But so much of the food and drink that we enjoy today is indebted to these men of yore who live behind cloistered monastery walls. And a good way to think about monasteries of yore is that they were self-sufficient operations, that you couldn't call up Cisco or Aramark and say, could you, you know, deliver me some carrots or some wine or anything. Everything had to be produced by the monks at the monasteries. On top of that, the many of these monasteries followed a vegetarian diet or one without quadrupeds or four-footed animals. And so cheese was a great way to get protein at this time. And of course, monasteries would have cows and there'd be surplus milk, and it'd be a way to preserve the milk and also get protein. On top of that, monasteries were the hotels of their day. If you were a pilgrim or a traveler, there weren't sort of hotels that you could pop into. And so you would spend the night at a monastery, and monasteries were very devoted to the art of charity and hospitality. And so cheese was a great way to nourish the travelers that were stopping by.
That's amazing. I mean, I feel like, I maintain that in the Middle Ages, you know, and onward, being a monk was actually a pretty great deal. I mean, you were safe. You had books to read, you know, you had more good food than most people would at that time. And so that's really fascinating. So cheese making would become basically a part of the daily routine of a monk at the monastery.
And it was a very prescribed routine. St. Benedict of Nursa came up with the rule of St. Benedict, or just the rule, and pretty much every hour of a monk's day was accounted for, either in prayer, meditation, eating, or labor, often agricultural labor, which was needed, of course, to make the monastery run. St. Benedict believed that idleness is the enemy of the soul. So the monks kept busy, but as you say, they were in a protected place. We sort of think of monks maybe running away from the world, but it was a turbulent world that they ran away from at the time of St. Benedict. You know, Rome had collapsed. There was
What year was this? I'm sorry, can I interrupt?
Yeah, sure. St. Benedict, nobody knows for sure his life dates. There isn't much of a record left of his life beyond the rule. But he lived probably from 480 AD to 547 AD. So we're talking a long time ago.
Wow. Wow. And so you were explaining that in a turbulent world, Rome had fallen, you know, people were kind of all just kind of fending for themselves. And
yeah,
so being a monk could be a good thing.
Right. Exactly. And they didn't have a luxurious diet, except what's more luxurious than cheese in the course. But but they did not have to worry about getting enough to eat, which I think is a really important thing to point out, because we often forget how difficult food was to come by in those days, especially when everything was produced on a small scale and not the big sort of way that food is produced today, that we don't even have to think about where our food is coming from or how we get it.
And Kara, what about the spirit side of things? So how did spirits and liqueurs come into play in the monks' lives?
Well, they fit in a lot of different ways. And I know we talk about the spirits, but I think it's also important to fleetingly mention beer and wine and ale and cider.
Oh, no, not fleetingly. Those things are very important.
Well, when it comes to beer and ale and cider and wine, too, to a degree, a lot of the time they were considered more foodstuffs than alcohol. In the medieval times, especially, water was often not safe to drink. So in addition to using these fermentation processes to preserve grains and fruit, this was also just a safe thing to drink. And there were monastic orders who really had very significant daily allotments of beer. I mean, far more than we would drink today on a daily basis.
Talk about, it's like drinking the Kool-Aid, but, you know, drinking the beer instead. They're like, no, this is, you have to do this. This is safe. If you drink water, no.
But really, truly, it wasn't safe. People really were getting very, very ill from drinking water. Mm. So it was convenient, I think, to have some of these other beverages fermented and thereby sanitized. And then when it came to wine, also it had festival and ceremonial uses. But when we're thinking about the spirits, it's less about food and more about medicinal applications. There's this grand monastic tradition of elixirs, and that's really where we get our Benedictine and Chartreuse come in, that they were to help heal.
Well, let's just talk about Chartreuse for a minute, because I find, you know, it's a tangent, but it's such a fascinating drink. I mean, I love the flavor of Chartreuse, but then when I found out a little bit more about the history of it, I was completely blown away. So I'm sure, yeah, tell us about Chartreuse and how it evolved.
Well, it still is made by Carthusian monks. It blows me away as well that it's still made in the monastic tradition, and I think it's the only product that's mass distributed and still made in the monastic tradition by monks.
And where are those Carthusian monks located?
In the French Alps.
Okay.
And you can go and tour the monastery, and it's very beautiful. We have some photos for our slides tomorrow. And it's made in all different... first, it's made in intense secrecy. Only three monks have the recipe at any given time, and it's divided up among three different monks. One has a third of the recipe, another has the next third, the other has the next third, and it's passed on in this very mysterious tradition through the generations.
Wow.
And it's really one of my favorite spirits. There's the green and there's the yellow, and I know some bartenders who really swear by the green being the better one, because it's in a lot of pre-prohibition recipes, and others swear that the yellow is the one because it has a more versatile flavor and lower alcohol, and they do taste very different and both very wonderful.
And so, but the liqueur itself, what is it made of?
It's made of well over 100 different herbs and spices and botanicals.
Wow, 100, over 100.
I think it's 130, and again, they each have different recipes. So the green one is made with, I think, more floral and herbal components, and then the yellow one has a bit more of like a honey, anise, licorice kind of taste to it.
That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. So it's actually funny, there are all these tie-ins, right? Because all the famous cheeses from the Alps, whether they were made by monks or not, are also reliant on those same grasses and herbs for their flavor.
Never thought of it that way. That's an interesting connection that you made there.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it's those monks are clever. Like, turn that grass into all kinds of good stuff. So Chartreuse is obviously a famous example. What are some other famous examples of monastic liqueurs?
I think Benedictine is the other well-known. And when I think of Benedictine, also another one made with a lot of herbs and spices and botanicals. Fewer, though. There are only, I think it's 27 is the number. Mm-hmm. And it has a very different flavor. It's more sweet and honey and vanilla and more spiced than any of the other liqueurs, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Really just beautiful, versatile. But when it comes to Benedictine, I mean, that also is a really fascinating story. And I think of that as being the story of two men, roughly 3 centuries apart. And the first is, of course, Don Bernard Vercelli. He's the monk who created the original recipe in 1510, for kind of 500 years. And he created it. And when the French Revolution came in, the monks had to flee to save their life. And the Benedictine order dispersed for a while. And the product is no longer made by monks.
Oh.
Okay. However, in the 1800s, another gentleman, Alexander Le Grand, I think of him as like the Donald Trump of his time. He inherited the land where the monks used to make their residence, and he rediscovered the book that held the famous recipe.
Whoa.
But he couldn't read it. So he hired a pharmacist to help him translate it, and it took over a year to recreate the recipe, but he did.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
It really is. And it's still made the same way that he rediscovered it and remade it. And the reason I say he's the Donald Trump of his time is because he turned this into really an empire. He created not only a huge business, but the mystique around Benedictine. He was the first to create advertising. The advertising posters you see of liqueurs, he was the first to do it.
Wow. And this was one in the 1800s, you were saying?
The late 1800s. I want to say 1860-ish is when he rediscovered the recipe and relaunched it.
Well, thank goodness.
Oh, yes.
I mean, yeah, we're super excited about that.
And the last thing that makes him so Donald Trumpish, and then I'll stop about this, is he created this entire palace. It's the Palace Benedictine. They literally have a hall of fakes of all the people who tried to recreate Benedictine. You can go and tour it, and it's really opulent and fabulous.
That's so funny. A hall of fakes, did you say, as opposed to the Hall of Fame?
Yes.
It's like being having your picture put up at the store. It's like, this person's a shoplifter. Don't let him in. Well, I think we have to take a really quick break here, but when we come back, we'll talk more about more types of monastic cheeses and how these things go together. Welcome back to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a very calm and sort of serious episode. No, we're not being too serious, but the music is definitely a little bit more serious than we usually go for. But beautiful monastic chants. You know, I could get down with that life. Making cheese, making beer, tending the garden, milking the cows, singing some songs, reading, you know, coloring in little illuminations on books. No, I'm just kidding. It's when we left off, we were talking about Benedictine, which is a famous spirit, and sort of the commercial aspect of how a monastic tradition was taken and made into a more commercial marketing phenomenon. And Diana, you were saying that there is an equivalent to that in the cheese world as well. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. There's nothing quite as grand or specific as the story of Benedictine with cheese. It's maybe more of a general story in the sense that very few cheeses that we know as monastic cheeses are still made in monasteries. And part of that reason is after the turbulence of the French Revolution and the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII, monks had to flee their monasteries, and the grand cheese-making traditions that they partook in fled with them. But the cheese making, or the types of cheeses that they made, were picked up by farmers in the countryside. And so they were made, the tradition was preserved that way. And then also they did develop into more large scale production. And the large scale production is good and bad. It's good in the sense that these traditions were continued, but then bad because sometimes, as we know, with mass production, there can be changes in the quality of the cheese. For a classic example might be Pont l'Evêque. There is definitely some great Pont l'Evêque out there, but then there's also a lot of commercially produced cheese that doesn't have the great depth of flavor as maybe a handmade one would.
Mm. Now, what are some monastic cheeses that are still made in monasteries?
I think a Baie de Belloc, which is a lovely Pyrenees sheep's milk cheese. It wouldn't be one that would come to mind immediately as a monastic style cheese, because most monastery cheeses were wash rinds, the great stinkers of the cheese world.
Mm.
But this is a lovely, elegant, sweet sheep's milk cheese. There are several actually in North America that are still made by monks, particularly in Kentucky and in Virginia.
Oh, I heard about that. We had on the state of cheese, I was doing a series about every different state, and the Jessamani
exactly,
monks in
yes,
Kentucky.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I thought, you know, monks coming from France and settling in the Smoky Mountains and continuing a French cheese tradition there, completely fascinating.
Right. I know we do tend to think of the monastic tradition as something of yore, this medieval monks just doing something very antiquated, but the tradition still thrives, and it thrives in monasteries by monks and nuns, but and then also just thrives in our culinary tradition. So much of what we eat and drink, as I've mentioned before, we owe to these men of long ago and women of long ago.
Well, I maintain they had time to sort of pursue these things when other ordinary people might not have had time to sort of labor and perfect and kind of, you know, just think about it to the degree that they did. As you mentioned, a lot of monastic cheeses are washed rind cheeses, which are very, very high maintenance in terms of labor. Can you describe for our listeners a little bit more about what's a washed rind cheese and how that process aids in cheese making?
Sure, I'd love to. Washed rind cheeses are usually distinguished by their orange rind, very sticky, wet, pungent orange rind. And that is the result of the presence of Brevibacterium linens.
Mm-hmm. And bee linens for short.
Yes. And the reason that these molds are like to grow on the surface of these cheeses is because the cheeses tend to be low acid and high moisture. And they ripen the cheeses from the outside in, breaking down proteins, and in that process release that stinky smell, but then also create these lovely, luscious, runny, beefy, bacony flavored cheeses. And the reason that they're so associated with the monastic world is that monks, or monasteries I should say, would have quite a few cows, and so the cows would be milked in the morning, and they would be able to have enough milk to make cheese then and there. And that's in contrast with maybe farm wives at the time in Normandy, who would just have a couple of cows and would do a milking, but it wouldn't be enough to make cheese. And so in the evening they would do another milking, and then they would pool this milk together, and during that time the milk would be acidifying, and it would be a high acid cheese. And as I mentioned before, bee linens doesn't like high acid. It likes low acid, but high moisture.
So a Normandy cheese would be like a brie or a camembert, one of those soft cheeses that's very nice and sort of tangy and buttery. And a monastic cheese would be something more like Chimay is a classic one that everybody knows.
A
Poisse, right. Okay.
The real Munster, as I mentioned, Pont-l'Evêque, Livereau, examples from the U.S., Hooligan, Paulette, is it?
Yeah.
From considered
Dorset,
Bardwell.
Absolutely. Right. Grayson, yeah.
But actually what's interesting is that those the camembert and brie and all the wash rinds we were just mentioning, they actually kind of, the recipes are very similar, but what really, and both are in the category of surface ripened cheeses, but where they do diverge is with the acidity of the cheese. And so the monks were able to attend to their milk very soon after milking to make cheese, and that also goes back to not only having a surplus of milk, but also because their schedule, their day is so rigid. Unlike a farm wife who has to fit in cheese making, at the same time taking care of kids and tending to the animals and
cooking and cleaning,
right,
or whatever else. Right. So they could make it right away, mm-hmm, allowing for a lower acid cheese because that milk hadn't had time to acidify.
Exactly. And then also, as I mentioned before, monasteries pretty much followed a vegetarian diet. So these lovely, meaty, stinky, rich cheeses were a great sort of substitute for meat, both in terms of protein and taste.
And now some of these washed rind cheeses are actually washed with spirits. Isn't that right?
Yeah, correct. And that's actually the other sort of link that we were making between monastic cheeses and spirits, is that washed rind cheeses can be washed in a simple brine solution, but they could also be washed in beer that, for instance, the classic is Chimay, that's washed in a Trappist ale, or a Langres, which is washed in champagne, or
a Poisse, which is Marc de Bourgogne. And
exactly.
Yeah, I don't know of any cheeses washed in chartreuse. We should try that.
I think so.
That would be expensive, but it would be delicious.
Can you imagine the pairings, the cocktails made with chartreuse and the chartreuse washed cheeses?
You know, I can't help it in my mind, you know, washed rinds are orangey. I just would think they would have this really vibrant hue. I can't help but think of like a really yellow or green cheese would come out of it.
Well, it's funny, you know, I have a cheese at the shop. It's called Chester, also from Consider Bardwell. And this year they made a couple of batches that were washed with a dandelion wine that Peter Dixon, the cheesemaker, also makes. And the rind was crazy. It was orange for sure, but it had a kind of almost fluorescent yellow quality to it. It was almost like luminescent. So I think, yeah, that could be an interesting experiment. We should, you know, we should see if we can arrange for that.
Did it taste like the wine?
No, it tasted, I mean, it had a very, very pungent flavor and very, very tangy, you know, and a little bit grassy, I guess, but it didn't
necessarily. I could imagine chartreuse going really well with something with more of a grassy flavor to it. That would actually be really nice.
Yeah. Well, so tell us a little bit about the pairings that you guys work, because of course you're educators, but you're also going to give people a taste of these things. So how do you go about choosing your pairings?
Well, the way we've done it previously is we've tried to set up wine and cider and spirits pairings with cheeses, and we found that actually pairing spirits and cheeses together is a little more challenging than you might think. But with
and wine, why is that?
The flavors just don't seem to be that complementary. I think a lot of spirits are. I think the alcohol makes it difficult to
and
to
some
pair.
Of them might have been used also were they also used more of as like a digestif kind of a thing where you would have it before or after meal as opposed to with food.
Exactly, digestif especially. I'm thinking about chartreuse, you've kind of got my mind going, because it kind of falls along the same line as the cheeses. Chartreuse has actually been used, it's a popular aid for farmers for flatulence in cows.
They would feed the cows chartreuse?
Yes.
Lucky cows.
Some happy cows.
I would be glad to be reincarnated as one of those cows.
So I'm wondering if maybe we're missing the boat here. We just haven't found the right cow giving the right kind of chartreuse-inspired milk to do the pairing.
So this is definitely our future, right? We have to find cows that have had consumed some chartreuse, take their milk, make cheese, and then wash them in chartreuse.
Yes!
Yeah,
this is going to be the most expensive cheese of all time.
But we found that it pairs really well with ciders and beer and wine. Of course, wine and cheese is a natural pairing. I don't know if it's just the lower alcohol that makes it easier to pair, but that's lovely. And I know for tomorrow, I think we're doing more individual tastings rather than spot-on pairings.
So, yeah, what are you guys tasting tomorrow? Can we get a little preview of the menu? Is that allowed?
Of course.
Well, for the spirits, we're, of course, doing Benedictine. They're one of our sponsors. And we're doing an enormous alchemist punch made with Benedictine and fruit juices, and it's really good. And then we're also doing small tastings of Crispin cider and tastings of the two different kinds of chartreuse, so everyone gets a little sample to see firsthand what it's like.
Lucky. And then on the cheese end of things?
We're going to be doing three cheeses. We're going to be doing Pont l'Evêque, the cheese I mentioned before. Also, Abbaye de Belloc, the sheep's milk cheese from the Pyrenees. And finally, Tête de Moine from Switzerland, a very, probably the strongest tasting Swiss cheese that's out there. And I brought in a Girolle as well for it, which is this lovely contraption, not invented until 1982, even though the cheese itself dates from, I think, 1282.
Really? They didn't invent that until, wow.
I know, amazing. It seems like this great antique way of cutting the cheese.
The contraption does look medieval. For anyone who hasn't seen it, it's like a circular sort of wooden base with a pole in the middle of it, and then this little handle that turns around in a circular fashion on the top. But I'll let Diana tell you how it works.
Right, and actually going back to sort of the medieval component, it does look a little bit like a torture device, because then you do take the little Tête de Moine, which is just a little wee cylinder of cheese, and you spear it onto this spike, and then you can take off the top, and then you run a blade around it in a circular motion, and it produces these lovely little floral-looking slices of cheese, like little rose petals, and it's a lovely way to eat, a sort of delicate way to eat this very robust cheese.
And I find when you eat the cheese that way, because you have, I guess, a lot of surface area, mm-hmm. you know, you end up tasting the cheese so much more because it is very kind of thinly done and delicate, mm-hmm. and it's just like this wonderful, it's a wonderful little burst of flavor. Well, that sounds fantastic.
We're going to have a good time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So now, do you guys have any evidence of monks partaking in big holiday festivities like the ones you're designing where they would lay out a grand spread and eat and drink and really enjoy themselves? Or is that kind of...
I think that's antithetical to the monastic lifestyle. I don't think they were throwing lavish cocktail parties by any stretch
of imagination. So I couldn't do it. I'm sorry. I revoke my earlier statements.
No. But that doesn't mean that they were totally absent from monasteries. As I mentioned, St. Benedict was the father of Western monasticism back in the 400s, 500s AD. But this tradition's been going on for 1,500 years, and monks haven't always been good, and there's been sort of lapses and monks who've enjoyed their wine a little too much, and the Trappist tradition, which we know very well, of course, from the Trappist ales, they formed in a response to people moving or monks moving away from the rigid rules of St. Benedict.
Interesting. Very interesting. So some people wanted to have a little fun with their daily routine.
Right. Well, even St. Benedict knew that he couldn't deprive monks of their wine. He just hoped that they would enjoy it in moderation.
Interesting. Very interesting. So what is this book that St. Benedict wrote? You were mentioning it before.
Yeah, it's called The Rule of St. Benedict, and it was he who put together a whole list of rules, regulations for monks to follow, because as I mentioned, that when he started his version of monasticism, it was a very turbulent world. There wasn't a lot of...
wasn't probably a lot of guidance for people if civilization wasn't providing that moral compass, you know? He must have taken it on.
Right, and there was a lot of corruption, and maybe monks enjoying themselves too much. And so this is a way for monks to devote themselves to a life of work and contemplation and meditation and prayer. And it didn't leave a lot of room for doing anything else but.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so actually, it spelled out what monks could and couldn't eat, what they should be doing, how many hours a day they should be reading or in prayer, and what they should be wearing. So it was every aspect of their life was accounted for in the rule of St. Benedict.
Fascinating. Fascinating. And to think that, 1,500 years of tradition have ended up on our plates today, and we still get to enjoy those things. Well, thank you ladies both so much for coming on the show. I would encourage anybody who doesn't have plans tomorrow night to check it out. Tell us the Culinary Historians website one more time.
Sure. It's www.culinaryhistoriansny.org.
Thank you. This has just been a wealth of knowledge, and we look forward to having you guys back on Uncutting the Curd. Maybe we can do some in-house tasting next time.
With our chartreuse cheese?
Yeah. Stay tuned.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.